With obesity increasing at an epidemic rate around the world, what are governments doing to combat this growing problem? What is the best way for our public servants to help, if at all? We also tackle your weightlifting questions and much, much more here in episode number 92 of Fat to Fit Radio.
Welcome to Fat to Fit Radio, your source for real weight loss solutions without the hype. And now, here are your hosts, Jeff Ainsley and Russ Turley.
Hello and welcome to Fat to Fit Radio. So Russ, we're just jumping right into your weight loss again. How are you doing? Did you break down into the 219 or 18 range?
I did not, Jeff. I am down to 221 right now, so lost about 3/4 of a pound since the last show, but reversed the weight gain that I had the previous week.
Can you remember the last time you were in the teens of the 200s?
I'm going to guess it was probably 11th grade in high school.
Wow, that's a long time. So hopefully the next show, because we've got about a week and a half before we're going to record the next show, hopefully we're going to get below there.
I'm hoping so. But let's go over the eating goals here and all the other ones as well. Eating goals, about an 8 out of 10, I'm going to say. Exercise goals, probably about a 6 out of 10. Can do better on those. And probably motivation for the week, probably a good 8 out of 10.
Well, you know, we've got about 4 or 5 months before we have the Fat to Fit Radio meetup and the show 100. We're going to lose 100 pounds. So are you starting to feel a bit of pressure here?
Yeah, you know, Doug Perry over on Facebook, he was telling me in a Facebook message that he's about the same weight as I am right now. And he's trying to match me pound for pound for the number 100 show. So I've got a little, I won't say it's a competition, just a little reminder that I got to get down there.
Well, that sounds good. But let's move into our email and comment section. And the first email came in from Kath from Australia.
First, may I say I've been listening to your podcast for a couple of years now and love your show. I find it informative and easy to listen to when I'm working out. I'm a 5'3" female and most of my adult life I have been sort of yo-yoing within my healthy weight range. Exercise has been a constant for me. Jogging, cycling, and weight training is always part of my weekly routine. I find that I have to be extra strict with my diet to stay under 60 kilograms. However, if I stop being so strict and just focus on having a balanced diet, my weight stabilizes somewhere between 60 and 64 kilograms. My question is, do people have a natural weight that their body gravitates to? I know that some people totally disputed that idea and say that does not happen. However, I have read more into it and have found some studies do support the theory of having a natural weight. And anecdotally, I see it with many of my friends. So what do you think?
Well, what you're asking about is formally known as the set point theory. This was proposed in 1982, and anecdotally, this has always been observed in people and animals. Just look back at pictures of families from the 1800s. They are all fairly similar in size. The basic theory is that we all have a natural weight, or more specifically, we have a natural amount of fat stores that our bodies will gravitate towards. A person's body is regulated by the concept of homeostasis. Your body likes to be at a certain temperature, for example, and you will sweat or shiver to regulate that temperature. It is also believed that you have a natural body fat percentage that your body gravitates to. Before I get too far along, everyone has a slight temperature variation that is natural for everyone's bodies to be at. This is not variable like 10 or 20 degrees between people, though. The same is true for a person's body fat percentage. There is a natural variability between two very similar people, but it is a reasonable range, not hundreds of pounds of variability. So what is that magic set point number for each of us? Well, it's really not so clear, but this seemed to be the best explanation that I could find.
Studies show that a person's weight at the set point is optimal for efficient activity and a stable, optimistic mood. When the set point is driven too low, depression and lethargy may set in as a way of slowing the person down and reducing the number of calories expended.
Now, this always happens when people get down to a crazy low body fat percentage. Some people can have six-pack abs and seem to live a normal life, but most people will be very depressed and lethargic and starving at this low body fat percentage. However, this sort of variability seems to show up at the extremes. And here's another explanation of how to find out what your natural weight should be.
If you eat when you are physically, not emotionally hungry, and stop for the most part when you are satisfied, you'll find your natural weight range. This is the weight that nature intended for your body. You can maintain this weight within a normal 5 to 7 pound range without dieting. There are a couple of caveats to this. If you are dieting, overeating, overexercising, or eating mainly processed foods, this will move your body away from its natural weight.
So this shows that your environment and food choices can affect your natural weight. Many obese people hear about this theory and say that their set point is the reason why they're overweight, and none of the diets that they've ever tried in the past have worked. I say it's a nice try, but I don't buy it. I might even buy 20 pounds, but I don't accept people taking a simple theory and trying to twist it around to make it as an excuse. When I looked at the research, very few studies tried to look at exactly this issue of set point. Most of the things that I found were from related studies that also added inferences about a person's set point in their conclusions, but they didn't specifically test for it. However, most of the studies backed this theory. The most compelling ones were twin studies that showed most twins are very close in weight throughout their lives. However, twins who lived apart in very different social environments had more variability when comparing the twins' weights. So the bottom line is, yes, it appears that we all have a natural set point. If you are overeating or eating mainly processed foods, the likelihood is that you are much heavier than what your true set point is. Let's say that you've been eating natural foods until you are full for a few years and have realized that your body weight has stabilized 10 pounds heavier than what you'd like. Is there anything that you can do to lower your body's natural set point? The answer, thankfully, is yes. Other studies have shown that you can lower this natural set point by adding in regular exercise.
Yeah, we've got a few links here that we'll add in the show notes, so check those out. All right, let's get into our second email here, and it's from Maritza, and she wrote, "Hi, Russ and Jeff. I've absolutely loved your blog since I encountered it almost a year ago. I especially enjoyed your recent show on Jim Carrey's Business Plan for the Body, as I bought this book after seeing it on the Oprah show many years ago and found it very helpful. In the book, Jim recommends limiting your cardio training and focusing on weight training to lose and maintain your weight. He states that if you look around the average gym, you will notice that the people working out on the cardio machines are generally overweight, while the people lifting weights are in much better shape. I would like your thoughts on this philosophy."
Well, I also agree with this, and I have worked out and worked in many gyms, and this is true. It's what you notice. People who are lifting weights in the middle of the floor, they generally are thinner and more muscular and have nicer bodies if you're just going to look at them, you know, from a distance and compare. The people who are on the cardio machines generally seem to be a little less in shape. And I think this really has to do with a natural progression. People come into a gym and they are very intimidated with lifting weights, and they see that it's very easy to ride a bike or get on a treadmill or something like that, and they stick with that for a couple months. I think it's a good progression, though, to start there where you feel comfortable and then look for a class or get some extra training on how to move into the center of the gym and start lifting some weights. And as for cardio being bad, I think everything in balance. You need to do what you find interesting and what you will stick to do and what you like. Doesn't matter if it's mainly lifting weights or mainly doing cardio, as long as you have some balance in there.
All right, good. Well, Maritza continued on here. "I would also like your opinion on his assertion that you should concentrate your weight training efforts on the back of the body. For example, hamstring work over quad work. Last question, I promise. Are you supposed to attempt to keep the front and back of your body in balance? For example, if you use 40 pounds for your leg extensions, should you also use 40 pounds on your leg curls? For some reason, I have picked up the idea that not doing so will throw my body off and increase the chance of injury, even though I'm able to lift more in either exercise. I appreciate your time and keep up the great work, Maritza." Well, I'm going to start answering this for the average person here. Purpose of doing resistance training is to keep your body strong and healthy and stop the natural decline in your muscle mass that naturally happens over time. As for whether you should be concentrating your efforts on the muscles on the back of your body or on the front of your body, the rule of thumb that we recommend is to spend your efforts on the largest muscles and the more compound movements. Instead of doing those isolated movements such as a wrist curl, do squats with a barbell on your shoulders and work dozens of groups of muscles at the same time. And of course, keep changing those workouts around as you work out.
And as for keeping your body in balance, your body isn't balanced strength-wise for all pairs of muscles, so don't worry about lifting the exact same amount of weight. If you look at your bicep and your tricep, for example, your bicep raises your arm and your tricep lowers your arm. Your bicep is much stronger than your tricep, so there's no need to try and work the same weights for both muscles, even though they are opposing one another. As well, many times when you're lifting a weight, you're not only using the exact muscles that you're trying to work on, you'll also be recruiting other muscles to some extent at the same time.
All right, we've got another quick question here on weightlifting, and it comes from Amy from Omaha.
And she wrote, "Hi guys, just found your podcast a few weeks ago and love it. Best health-related podcast I've found. I'm in a healthcare profession, and although I know the basics and try to lead a wellness-based life, I've been listening to the back podcasts and have learned some great information. My question, I've read a little bit about slow speed strength training, and I've given it a try with free weights at home. I like it, and it seems to be working for me. I've lost several inches. You've done such an outstanding job answering questions in an evidence-based manner. I'm interested in what you have to say about slow speed strength training. Thanks for the podcast. It's a real motivator, Amy.
Now, we both think that slow speed strength training is great. There's really no perfect form of weight training. Everything that you do, your body will eventually adapt to, so there's nothing wrong with everybody going through a phase once in a while of slow lifting. The real trick is to be changing up how you do your resistance training every once in a while. You can change many things around, such as the number of reps, the number of sets, or the amount of weight or resistance, or how much you rest between sets. What most people don't consider is the speed of the exercise.
And most of the mistakes that I see people doing in the weight room, it deals with people lifting weights too quickly, mainly because they're trying to lift something that is too heavy, and they just want to get some extra body swing in there to cheat up with the weight as well. The slower that you lift, the better your form has to be, and the more isolating each exercise will be. To give people an idea of just how slow this training is, you generally lift the weight for 2 seconds, pause for 1 second at the top, and then slowly lower the weight for 4 seconds. It is a safe method of resistance training, mainly because the dangers of momentum are removed. There have been a handful of studies that have been published, and they have all shown that people have gained strength through this method. Now, it isn't for everyone because some people might find it tedious, but if this type of exercise is working for you and you are getting results, keep it up. Now, as for the studies and references, I'm going to leave a link in the show notes from the University of New Mexico, which summarizes super slow resistance training and discusses some of the studies about it for those who are interested.
Well, that's going to do it for our email and comments for the show. I want to thank Kath and Maritza and Amy for their contributions. Keep them coming. All right, if you'd like to get your comment or question to us, there are a few ways you can do that. The first one is by leaving a comment on the website at fattofitradio.com.
Or you can send us an email to podcast@fattofitradio.com.
Third way is to leave a voicemail by clicking on the Call Me button over on the website, fattofitradio.com.
Or you can join our support group at fattofitsupport.com.
All right, now we're going to get into the web report with a couple of news items. Jeff, what do you have for us?
Well, I have one thing that came out this week, and it is all over the news everywhere. It is showing that women who drink a little bit of alcohol tend not to put on as much weight as people who don't drink alcohol. And here's some samples of headlines from The Independent in Great Britain. Bottoms up for skinnier bottoms. From The Globe and Mail in Canada, a drink a day could help keep the pounds away. From The Herald Sun in Australia, cheers, wine refines the waist. From India, wine isn't fattening, ladies. And from Women's Day in the United States, want to stay thin, have a drink. Now, this was a study that tracked 19,000 women over 13 years. Now, at the start of the study, all of the women had BMIs between 18.5 and less than 25. So they're all considered of average weight. No one was overweight to any extent. Now, after 13 years, which is a little bit saddening, they found that 41.3% of the women were now overweight. You know, that's a huge number. The people who gained the most weight did not drink any alcohol. And the people who gained the least weight averaged about 2 drinks of alcohol per week. And they found that if they were drinking red wine, they gained the least amount of weight. And I think this is a very interesting study. It is more of a correlational study. I'm not sure that they can prove that drinking this wine is the reason. They did try and work out the other factors. They adjusted for age, the baseline BMI where people started, whether the people smoked or not, the physical activity level, and they tried to find a lot of other lifestyle and dietary factors. But they did have this correlation, and I do think it's interesting. They've been saying that red wine is good. I have nothing against alcohol. There are extra calories in there, but there's obviously some other factors that are having a good impact. I guess it's still not great that 41% of these women are now overweight, but maybe every little bit can help, so a glass or two of red wine just might be good for you. Now, I will leave a link to the actual study in the Archives of Internal Medicine. There's a little summary that you can read, and I'll leave a link to another news article where you can kind of get all of the scoop about it. So, Russ, what do you have?
Well, I have here, it's good news and bad news, Jeff, a little bit of each. Australian scientists have shown that humans can detect a sixth kind of taste, which is fat. Now, we've all got taste for sweet, salt, sour, bitter, and this is an interesting one. I haven't really heard about too much. Umami, which is a taste for protein-rich foods. Now, we can all taste fat in our mouth. You know, it's got that kind of, you know, kind of rich taste to kind of coats the mouth. But they found that some humans can identify the taste of fat rather than its texture. So it's not just that you're tasting the, you know, how the fat feels in your mouth. It's actually that you have a chemical reaction in your mouth to fat in it. So they're now trying to use this to treat obesity. Because those people who have this taste for fat, who can taste it very readily, have a lower BMI. They don't have as much fat as those who can't taste this, the fat chemicals. So it's very interesting. They're going to do a little more study on this, but obviously they're trying to find a way to create a pill that all of us can take so then we don't eat as much fat, assuming that that's what our vice is, that we're all eating fat in particular. And that's why we're overweight, which we all know is not 100% the case. It's one of the factors, but it's very interesting that we can actually taste fat. And now it's another thing that the human body can do. It's very exciting.
Well, I read this article and I was thinking maybe the people who can taste fat have lower BMIs because they don't like the taste of fat. And there's an aversion thing going on here. So they're not eating things with fat. Now, not that fat makes you fat, but it does have a high caloric thing. And if you eat things with less fat, there's lower calories. What do you think about that idea, Russ?
Well, I think that's what they're saying, you know, yeah, that those people who can actually taste fat, yeah, they don't like it. And so they're avoiding it. Well, it'll be interesting to see what comes of this study. And if they do actually come up with a pill that'll make me not like the taste of fat. That'll be interesting. But let's get on to today's feature section.
Today's feature section is about how the obesity epidemic is becoming a political issue in many countries around the world. As countries and states try to fight the obesity epidemic, they are passing laws and creating regulations left and right that will somehow, hopefully, make people thinner and healthier. Now, if you step back and try to see this globally, on one hand, you have people who can afford to purchase an amount of food that is well over their caloric needs and can simply eat for pure pleasure and enjoyment. Then on the other hand, there are organizations and governments who look at the escalating healthcare costs associated with obesity and the lower economic production of an entire society due to poor worker production caused by obesity-associated illnesses. So in other words, people want the freedom to eat and gorge themselves if they want to, and various organizations want to stop people from having that freedom for the greater good of the society. Now, fair warning, this is not going to be a political diatribe for or against any political party or ideology. We have listeners in somewhere around 100 countries, and in all of these countries, they are dealing with the same issues to some extent. One thing that I discovered is that different countries around the world are using politics to attempt to combat obesity. I'm going to take a look at what they're doing and if it is even feasible to combat a nation's obesity through all of these various legislations. Most of us have seen this happen in the past with tobacco in many countries around the world. Tobacco is clearly a health hazard and has been proven to injure and kill people, and of course it is addictive. Governments in many countries around the world have used regulations and policies to discourage people from smoking. This has saved countless lives from people who have stopped smoking and the people who have never started smoking in the first place. You can argue whether or not it took away people's freedoms, but it did make it much harder to be a smoker. In many cities in Canada and the US, smoking isn't allowed in public places like restaurants and businesses. Where I live in Canada, here's what the governments at various levels have done to combat smoking. First of all, they raised the legal age to purchase cigarettes to 18. Second, cigarette advertisements have been banned for years. Third, a few years ago, all cigarettes sold in stores must be completely out of view of the public. So they're now hidden in cupboards or under the counter with the cash registers. You cannot see a package of cigarettes in any store. And lastly, any businesses that are considered to be health-related, such as pharmacies, are not allowed to sell cigarettes any longer. And since most grocery stores and other large stores like Walmart's have pharmacies in them, all of these businesses stopped selling cigarettes. The people who truly want to smoke still can smoke, but in combination with legislation and society's attitudes towards smoking changing, the smoking rates are declining. Of course, tobacco and obesity are somewhat related, but obesity is a much more complicated issue and is much harder to change. It is clearly unhealthy as well, but you can't point a finger at one cause. For example, I have heard people say that they should just ban all McDonald's restaurants and that would help. Then they could put in more healthy restaurants like a Subway, which has meals with the same or higher calories, fat, etc. as the evil McDonald's. Every simple solution like this seems to fall apart. Now, I wanted to find out what governments around the world have been doing to attempt to combat obesity, and I found a great research paper entitled Obesity, a Hidden Political Issue. This is from East Carolina University, and I'll have a link so that anyone interested in reading this 40-page document can read it in full. I found it really interesting, and it takes a very good look at the big picture of obesity in politics, but I'll just pull out some of the main points here. Its first main point is that there are clearly many causes of obesity. Everything from our technological advances that make it easier for people to have a more sedentary lifestyle, to more available energy-dense foods like junk food and fast food, to simple laziness of people. Depending on what a particular government believes to be the cause of obesity, that will determine how they will try to combat it. It is very likely that different places can infer radically different causes and cures. One place could ban McDonald's, and another could build more recreational facilities, for example. The paper continues on to explain that there are three main places of blame that governments have historically taken as to the cause of obesity. Based on what they believe the cause of obesity is, determines what they will do about it. So the first cause is biological factors that a person has no control over, such as their genes. This naturally takes most of the responsibility off of the obese person. This leads to research into medical solutions such as drugs and bariatric surgeries and more funding going into healthcare. Now, secondly, if the main cause of obesity is thought to be the nature of our society and the environmental factors, then the individual person doesn't seem to be targeted, but laws are passed to try to do things like make school lunches healthier, banning things in foods like trans fats and sugars, and higher taxes on bad food. And lastly, if the main cause of obesity is because of a person's behaviors, then the responsibility falls on the individual and their family. The main way that you can tell a government believes that this is the cause is that if they focus their efforts on a variety of educational programs and do things like support daily physical education in the schools. If I was going to rank these three causes in importance, I would say that behavior is number one, followed fairly closely by society, and then in a very, very distant third, I would put biological factors. Now, of course, nothing is ever cut and dry, and many governmental policies and laws try to address all of these causes to some extent. I'm going to list 8 of the most popular governmental programs that I've found that have been enacted around the world in the last several years and give you some of my opinions as to whether they are effective. And I'm just one opinion here, and maybe something that I find to be useless would really help you and your neighbors where you live. If you agree or disagree, let us know in the comments section of this show over at fattofitradio.com. So to start, one major initiative is to increase spending on public parks and recreational areas with the reasoning that the more opportunities people have to do recreational activities, the more active people will be. I personally like it because I go out in the wilderness and use wonderfully groomed hiking trails out in the bush and in the mountains and rarely run into other people. Which of course leads me to think that while nice, it doesn't always apply to a large number of people, so maybe that money isn't being used effectively. Another one here. We have all heard about increasing the requirements for phys ed in schools with the thought that this will help reduce childhood obesity and that these active habits will continue long past school age. Now, I am a phys ed teacher and I do support this, but only if it is done correctly. There is a huge difference between having a phys ed specialist with proper training in phys ed and having a generalist teacher with no training at all taking over phys ed classes. This is what normally happens, especially at the younger grades, and phys ed simply becomes an extra recess for the students. This does seem like a no-brainer solution to most people, but it takes a lot of money to build more gymnasiums in the schools, hire more qualified teacher, and then deal with the loss of instructional time in core subjects. There are definite challenges to properly implement this, but I think education is extremely important. And I guess my bias is coming out here because I believe that a major cause of obesity is the actions and behaviors of the individual person, and education will help with this. The younger you start educating people about health and fitness, and the longer you have to repeat key lessons over and over and over again, the better. Another common initiative is that governments like to regulate food advertising to children. The thought is that if children don't see ads for unhealthy foods, they won't be interested in eating them. This is a tricky one because they will still be exposed to all of these junk foods at birthday parties and schools, etc., but I do see their point. Any parent will agree that children are very easily influenced by ads. I remember as a kid constantly fighting with my parents because they would never buy the cereals advertised on Saturday morning cartoons. I remember constantly telling my parents that Frosted Flakes and Count Chocula and Sugar Smacks were really good, and indeed they were actually healthy, even though I had never tasted them. At a minimum, reducing the ads targeted at children might reduce the nag factor for parents and make it easier for parents not to buy this junk food for their kids. As to whether this will stop children from ever eating and getting a taste for junk foods, I don't think that it'll have much of an impact. The main difference will be the lack of brand loyalty. A kid with a dollar in their hand in a candy store will still choose something even if they aren't conditioned to buy a certain brand. The next initiative is becoming more common, and that is where governments increase the taxes on high sugar and high fat snack foods. The thought is that if a chocolate bar costs $5, then people will eat less of them. I'm going to link to a recent article from the LA Times that addresses this issue. They found that a 10% increase in the price of soda and pizza led to a 7% decrease in soda consumption and an 11.5% decrease in pizza consumption. But this is just a classic sin tax. When it is considered sinful to eat certain foods, those foods get taxed more and cost more. I think this one is only marginally effective in the long run, even though it is shown to have an effect in isolated studies. It would only truly be effective if you could raise the prices in every single business. And let's just say for argument that you increase the price of sodas everywhere. Then more people will start drinking more sports drinks or energy drinks, which are just as bad. And then you end up on the slippery slope of always increasing what you consider to be bad. There are just too many choices of fattening foods out there. And yes, junk foods and processed foods do have their place in the obesity epidemic, but people can gain weight by eating too much of any type of food. The classic example that I'm thinking of is the sumo wrestler. They eat a healthy diet. They just eat way too many calories. It's as simple as that. Now, of course, there is the opposite side. On the flip side, instead of increasing prices, governments have also been lowering prices of healthier foods by giving tax breaks or subsidizing some of the cost of production. Now, I like this one because if you live in a colder climate like I do, the consumption of fruits and vegetables goes way down in the winter as their prices go up. So this would help me out. This is a positive solution. If you think of psychology, this is positive reinforcement. You reward people for doing the things that you want them to by giving them a break on price. Another very common one that we've talked about on the show is where governments attempt to improve the standards for school lunch programs, daycare programs, summer camps, etc. On one side, people will argue that it is a waste of time because students, for example, will still eat most of their meals and snacks outside of school, and it won't have that much of a difference to the overall caloric intake of those students. I see this point, but I favor this one because even if it's true, there's nothing wrong with encouraging feeding children healthy meals. It is almost always cheaper and easier to feed junk to kids, and I don't see anything wrong with making sure that children are fed at least one healthy meal when they are out in a public situation. And speaking of schools and our young, another common initiative that we've talked about on the show is to limit or ban soda and vending machines in schools. And if you want to talk about politics, it is very common for schools to partner with companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi to receive funding for their school. So it isn't as easy as just taking them out in many cases. It is a good start, but there are many situations where it doesn't seem to make a difference. I have experience dealing with this issue at a few schools where I've taught. In one situation, they removed the sugary soda and replaced it with sport drinks and juices. If the concern was fighting obesity, they have done nothing to reduce the number of calories that students are drinking. This can also create an underground market. In the high school where I currently teach, a student was caught last year selling energy drinks out of his locker because they were not in the vending machines. Many schools are also right next door to convenience stores that sell junk food. This strategy seems to work with younger grades, but it loses its effectiveness with the older grades as they become more mobile and as they have more money. Now, the very last government initiative that I'm going to mention is the one that I agree with the most, and that is increasing public education about obesity and the issues associated with being obese. This can be done in a variety of ways. This can be everything from quality health programs in the schools, to sponsorships, to living healthy programs, to public service announcements, and even to regular advertisements on TV and radio promoting a healthy agenda. The biggest thing that I've noticed over the last couple of years of doing Fat to Fit Radio is that the average person's level of understanding about fitness and obesity issues is dismal. I'm sure that everyone at some point in their lives has taken a health class or two on basic nutrition and learned most of the basics of fitness during a phys ed program, but after years and years of hearing about crazy diet and training programs from the media and hearing hundreds of sound clips and newscasts about this or that study that found that this nutrient is good or bad, most people are overloaded and totally confused. At age 10, someone might fully understand eating healthy from a health class, but those few hours learning about it in school is no competition for the thousands of other health messages that they will receive over the next 10 or 20 years. There are some ads that I've seen in the past that have encouraged people to eat more fruits and vegetables, for example, but they are so dwarfed out by the sheer volume of other ads that they don't have much of an impact. I think that putting money and resources into education is one of the most important things. So these are some of the strategies that are happening around the world right now by governments to try and fight the obesity epidemic. I think that it is clear to see that none of these strategies by themselves are going to make a heck of a lot of difference. And I'm not really sure that it is truly possible for any sort of government to be able to truly force its population to become thinner and healthier if they don't buy into it in the first place. All that we can really hope is that our governments at various levels choose strategies that everyone will buy into and make a difference. There really isn't a question as to whether most governments will look at fighting the obesity epidemic. It is really a question of what strategies they are using and will be implementing in the future. Now, just to sum up, I looked at dozens more regulations than what I mentioned here. Everything from giving tax breaks to healthy people, providing free gym memberships, listing all of the calorie counts on menus, to even banning large people from making purchases of unhealthy foods. The conclusion that I came to is that you can attempt to regulate things until a government goes bankrupt. I don't have any problem about regulations that are clearly in the best interest of the population and their health, you know, such as banning trans fats. But the focus needs to be convincing the public that they want to be healthy and then providing clear, easy, and concise information about how to do it.
Well, Jeff, that's really interesting. You know, I'm very happy to say that California has become the first state to ban trans fats in restaurants, and except for all but like donuts, I think, is what the last holdout here. But yeah, in 2010, it's the year of no trans fats in restaurants. So that's a very great news. And otherwise, yeah, I think education, that's what we do here on the show. We educate. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that any government or individual or group can do to help stave off obesity.
Well, it's just amazing. All of the regulations that are happening in every country around the world, there's just so many crazy hairball things when you really research it. We should do a show on the craziest things that people are doing or governments are doing. But it is really a global issue that people are trying to respond to. Well, let's move on and go to the recipe of the week.
Yes, this week's recipe, you know, a friend of ours is sick and my wife decided to make their family some dinner. And she made some chicken soup, some homemade chicken soup. And it was delicious. I thought, you know what, that should be our recipe this week. So I've got here a homemade chicken soup recipe. It's got chicken and carrots and celery and onions and a little chicken bouillon, which is always good in there. And it's only 152 calories per serving. And you can't go wrong with soup, especially if it's cold out. You're on the couch, you're wrapped up in a blanket. Have some soup. And so check out the recipe, the homemade chicken soup.
That sounds good. I love chicken soup.
All right, Jeff, what is our homework for all the good people at home this week?
The homework this week is to experience the type of eating that we talked about earlier when we mentioned how people can, over time, discover what their body's natural weight just might be. I challenge people to try only eating natural, unprocessed foods, only to eat when they are hungry, eat slowly, and then stop when they are full, and see what happens. Will you be losing weight? Is your natural set point a little bit lower than what you are? Only one way to find out.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize what actual hunger feels like. We eat so often and we don't realize that hunger feeling when it's actually upon us. It's good homework. All right, Jeff, what is our quote for the week?
The quote comes from William Feather, and he said, "Success seems to be largely a matter of hanging on after others have let go."
All right, it's a great quote. Thank you, Jeff. And all the links to everything we talked about will be in the show notes at fattofitradio.com. Look for show number 92. Thank you for participating in the show. Again, thank you for downloading and listening. And we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Send your feedback or questions to podcast@fattofitradio.com. For more information on today's show or any previous shows, visit the website at fattofitradio.com. If you would like to support the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast directory.